Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You got a plane to catch, I guess.
Yeah, flying that, I think it's not till 4:50.
Okay. So. But I'm expecting this to take a bit more than 1 hour, perhaps.
Fine. Yeah.
But like I said, let me know if you need a if you need a break.
I really love the North Face Speaker series, where selected North Face athletes from the international team tours the world and inspires their audience. For me, these are also excellent opportunities to expand my list of international names in my gallery. My name is Magnus Ormestad, and this is the Swedish outdoor podcast Husky. Andy Hausman would probably describe himself as just a normal guy who loves climbing and loves mountains. But Andy, with his team, got nominated for the Piolet d'Or, or the Golden Ice Axe, back in 2010. And for those of you who don't know, well, you don't end up being nominated if you're just a normal guy. So please join me and Andy for a talk about his background, how he got into alpinism, and the Link SAR project. Husky is made possible thanks to Naturkompaniet, and it is powered by Nordic Green Energy, Sweden's greenest energy company with 100% renewable energy sourced from solar, wind, and hydropower. Find them at nordicgreen.se. Welcome to episode 25 of the Husky International series, and a long interview with the British alpinist Andy Hausman. If you want to know more about this episode and of previous episodes, please head over to huskypodcast.com or find me on Facebook and Instagram at the handle huskypodcast.
Is it the first time in Stockholm?
Yeah, my first time in Sweden.
First time in Sweden.
So.
Because I saw on your Instagram
a
picture like flying into Stockholm.
Yeah, yeah.
You said something about like wishing that you had time to check out the trails and the scenery.
Yeah, it's a bit of a shame to say first time I come to Sweden and I've got literally one night in a hotel in Stockholm. It's a bit like when people come to London for work for a day, you don't actually see any of the actual country or. But yeah,
that's a good thing with Stockholm actually, because it's not a big city, but it is a city, and the nature is very close.
Yeah.
So actually 10 to 20 minutes from here you have like proper trails for running.
Yeah.
And even climbing and swimming, of course, and kayaking and so on. So it's very, the nature is always present in a way.
Yeah. No, I think I was really busy at work, so I couldn't come out any earlier, and I've got a friend's wedding at the weekend, so I had literally 2 days. So if not, I'd have liked to come out for either a couple of days earlier, a day late, and spent a bit of time around.
But because I was actually thinking about that biking into this interview, is that a problem for you sometimes to kind of, once you go abroad, it's either for stuff like this, the North Face Speaker Series, so it's kind of a work event, or it is for more massive climbing expeditions or climbing trips, so you don't have the luxury of like going back to, say, if you wanted to go back to Stockholm for like a weekend or 2-3 days to go a bit of, I don't know, see the city, but also go out and enjoy the nature. That is kind of a luxury that you can't afford when it comes to your time, your schedule.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, for me, just normal holidays are important as well. Mm. So I'm not a full-time climber, so I've got, you know, a full-time job as well. And I've got a lovely girlfriend as well, so we need to get the, get the proper holidays in as well. So I think not all my time isn't just extreme expeditions. You know, I do a lot of, most of the time I'm just doing normal stuff that you, everybody else, just whether it's out running, out road biking, climbing, yeah, doing a lot of just normal stuff as well, and it's.
But you get the rope sling over you, and you got the crampons on. So is that just an image?
that's just the image they portray. You know, the hero shots.
Yeah. No, but it is possible for you to just what you said, going on a.
Enjoy it and experience a place for what it. Mm. What it is, and not go just with a purpose of a specific goal in mind. Yeah, no, I like that as well. I like lazy days of not doing much and just drinking coffee and taking in the sights.
Where are you from?
So I'm from Yorkshire, which is in North England. Just a really small village called Darley. Nearest town's a place called Harrogate, and it's just on the edge of the Yorkshire Dales. So it's really, really, really nice countryside. Just rolling, like you were saying earlier, just rolling hills like Sweden.
Very similar to the Swedish mountain range.
There's no big mountains to go alpine climbing in, but we've got loads of really good rock climbing. Mm. The road biking's really taken off, and yeah, just get really close to get out running. Yeah, because straight out from my door on trails.
And that's where you live today as well?
Yeah, that's where I live now. I was born there and live there now. I've moved away and I've just always spent time living away. Like, spent quite a lot of time in Chamonix living for the winters. But no, I live back there. I've got a family business with my dad. So,
but is that like, was the nature there a big part of? Of course, nature there was a big part of shaping you. But that's the kind of that's what brings you back.
Yeah,
like the nature.
Yeah, I think I've always been not necessarily just the nature, but just the outdoors. You know, a lot of my mates when I was growing up at school, they'd go and hang out in the nearest town on a Saturday, whereas I'd be floating down the river on a tractor tyre, me and my mates have blown up and things like that, you know, and that sort of thing. That's always, I've always been attracted to that side of life rather than the city life, I think. And yeah, just like being outdoors.
But did that come from your parents?
I think so. I mean, like, my parents aren't into climbing or anything like that, but they're all from farming backgrounds. So, and working outside, whether it's, you know, in the whole industry, farming. So, I think, yeah, they've always instilled, just not on purpose, but just the way of country life is. It's about being outdoors and
Picking berries and mushrooms.
Yeah, yeah. Like, they're not, you know, my parents aren't environmentalists or outdoorsy people, but they like being outdoors and they so yeah, I think it's more just the situation I grew up in, the where we lived. It was, you were outdoors. You know, there wasn't much. It's a small village. There wasn't really any places to go hang out, so if you wanted to go play with your mates, you were messing about outside, which is great.
Running around with a stick in your hand.
Yeah, and I think I used to be really jealous of my friends that would go and hang out at McDonald's on a Saturday lunchtime, and I couldn't get into town to do that. But looking back now, I'm like, I was really fortunate. You don't appreciate, it's like a lot of things, you maybe don't appreciate it at the time, but you look back and think, well, actually, yeah, I didn't really miss out on much. I had a I definitely had the better deal there.
Do you know what it was? Was in a kind of an element of this could sound a bit cliche, but do you think that there was kind of an element of adventure or a dream of adventures that kind of like attracted you in all of that?
I don't know. It's not like I never had a defining moment. I was like, right, I want to go climbing, explore the mountains. I think I've just always been, I don't know why. And you often get asked that question, you know, when you do interviews, you can say, what drew you to it? I haven't actually come up with an answer for it yet. It's just, I just love being outdoors in the mountains. And for me, it was a natural progression from hill walking with scouts when I was younger.
Hey, you were a Boy Scout.
Yeah, I was a Boy Scout. It's great. We had an amazing scout leader. Yeah. It was really good fun. It wasn't your average scouts. It was just a bunch of lads having a good laugh. And yeah, we did a bit of hill walking in the Lake District and that.
Did you learn some like bushcraft skills?
Yeah,
and
learn how to light fire, you know, tie a few knots, and we used to just make mad big structures. And Yeah, and yeah, we did quite a bit of walking and stuff with that. And I guess from that, I got into, there's loads of climbing around me, but I say not my parents or friends climb, but kind of just somehow got into it. My maths teacher at school had a big poster of Dan Osmond on the wall doing the big crucifix, just soloing. And he lent me some books about climbing and took me to the local climbing wall. And I guess I got into that, and then really at university started climbing properly. So I was quite, you know, compared to some people, I was quite late.
Late bloomer.
Yeah, yeah. I think every year, as a family, we'd go skiing once a year or every other year.
Where did you go then?
We often went to Austria. Mm-hmm. So I think I've always been in the mountains one way or another, and I think that's where the draw for it. But
did you find, like, early on kind of a talent for climbing, or was it more like the fact that you liked it?
I just liked it. I just enjoyed it. Mm. I just first started rock climbing. I wasn't a super talented rock climber or anything, just average. Go out with my mates, have good fun. We go up to the Peak District. I was at Nottingham University, so we're really close to the Peak District, Derbyshire. So I'd spend a lot just out there at weekends. And yeah, no, I wasn't super talented or anything.
But you started indoors and then you went, like, climbing outdoors?
So I mainly started outdoors, really, just messing about the local crags. A bit of both, outdoors and indoors, but predominantly just climbed outdoors. I see a lot of people now that come into it, and I think it's great what climbing walls have done for the sport. They've definitely attracted a lot of people to it that wouldn't necessarily have got into climbing.
Now, if you look at the development now, it seems like it's... Like bouldering is like super trendy,
yeah,
and it's like all the major cities, and they got beautiful, amazing climbing walls. And now it's becoming, or it may become, part of the Olympics. Like the speed
climbing. It's part of the Olympics for is it 2020 or 2020 in Tokyo? Is it? I can't remember which year. But yeah, I mean, I'm not that involved in that side of climbing, but for me personally, I still love rock climbing, and it's great. And my local climbing wall in Harrogate, it's great to see. When that first started, there was a lot of people just started bouldering there that never climbed outdoors, and now they're actually really keen boulderers, really super strong. And yeah, it's interesting to see that progression of people coming through the climbing walls. And
was the social part of your development as a climber, was that as important as anything else, like the fact that you were doing it with your friends?
Yeah, I think that's, for me, climbing and friendship go hand in hand. You know, I only go away on expeditions with people I'm really good mates with. I'm not interested on going, if Joe Bloggs is a really good climber, let's just go and try this mountain. For me, you've got to go away with one of you. And that's like, yeah, I've only got a few, there's only a few people I've done expeditions with, and they've all been really good friends. And I think that's, you know, you've got it because you spend so much time with them.
Yeah.
If you don't get on with someone,
we're gonna return to that, actually, because that's a topic that I want to talk with about you. but you said you got books from your math teacher and so on, about climbing, and I read somewhere that you got you had these people as role models. You had British climbers as kind of house gods or role models, Joe Tasker, Peter Boardman, Alex McIntyre.
Yeah,
and they were kind of pioneers when it comes to alpine style, like kind of the light and fast trend.
Yeah, definitely. So I think I started by we'll say borrowing books from the school library. I don't think I returned them all, actually. Some of them might still be on my bookshelf. And a lot of them were like the Chris Bonington's books, and I just found it really inspiring reading about their trips to the greater ranges. And I didn't know anything about alpine climbing at that time, so you know, I got into reading about that. And at that stage, with the tricks that Chris Bonington was leading, it was still very much climbing in a siege style. So there'd be a big team of maybe 12 climbers, and they'd slowly work their way up the mountain, you know, fix ropes, camps,
and
fixing the lines, fixing the camps. And to me, I didn't know anything about climbing at that time, so I thought that was just the way it happened. Mm. But it was really interesting reading about the stories from back in the 60s when they're doing that. But then as I got more and more into climbing and learned more about the whole sport of alpinism. This is before I actually did any alpine climbing. You kind of realised that was the that times had progressed a lot since then, and it was the likes of Alex McIntyre, you know, Pete Bowman, Doug Scott that started taking the Alpine style to the greater ranges, and yeah, some of the stuff that Alex McIntyre and those guys did is just, yeah, it's really impressive how they changed the way of thinking, which is how we all climb nowadays. And yeah, just, yeah, I think there's been some really inspirational British figures. Lucky to know a few, not super well, but know a few of them, like Andy Kay and stuff, and they're just super nice guys, and it's quite funny, these guys that you've read about and you're really inspired and about, and you actually, you're standing around having you almost call them a friend now, and it's nice, and they're just down to earth.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite a big thing about the British scene. It's all pretty down to earth. There's not too many big egos or anything there. It's just,
I think it's a bit like that with the entire outdoor scene.
Yeah, definitely.
From my perspective, yeah. That it's most of the people that you end up meeting, they are very, like we talked about Simona Moro, for instance, yeah. Before the interview. And once you meet him, he's like I wouldn't say normal guy.
Yeah.
but he's very humble, and he's very, it's a great guy. But could you say something about, because I'm not a climber myself, but I know that British climbing history, you got a very rich tradition. Do you know where that stems from?
I guess originally it was the gentleman explorers back in the original day, in the, you know, in the late
1800s. In the colonial days.
Yeah, in the colonial days. Yeah, we probably shouldn't go to that. I guess if you go right back to the start, it was a lot of the more well-to-do British gentlemen that were out in the Alps, and they'd hire the local people to take them up mountains. But I guess my actual knowledge of climbing history isn't that great, but for me, I've followed it more from like the 60s onwards. Yeah. And I think that's a pretty impressive age for British mountaineering, especially out in the European Alps, in Chamonix and around that area. A lot of the classic routes were climbed by Brits and stuff. And it's, I don't know why. I think definitely the type of climbing we do in the UK helps when you get out to the big mountains. We used to Scotland, it's pretty bad weather. We used to suffering in going out. If you wait till the good conditions and the good weather, you're not really going to get very much done. When it is sunny, it's pretty beautiful. Yeah. I'm not sure what's driven it. I think there's just amongst the working class, there's been definitely there's been a big tradition with the clubs. It's like you read about the old Rock and Ice Club and all those clubs from back in the day, and yeah, I don't know what's driven that, but
it's interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah,
I'll probably not come up with the answer you want, but
these three names that I mentioned earlier, Tasker, Boardman and McIntyre, I had no idea who they were. So I clicked into their Wikipedia pages,
yeah,
and I found out that they all died young.
Yeah, they all died very sadly, very young, and I think that's definitely one of the darker sides of the success of British alpinism in the greater ranges. There was definitely an era where there was a lot of climbers sadly getting killed because they were pushing the level, they're pushing the standard, they're pushing it a lot more than what I think it's been pushed recently. But I think the step they took back then of taking that alpine style to the greater ranges was a massive, it probably wasn't appreciated at the time, but it was an absolutely massive step forward. And yeah, I think the routes they were trying were definitely a bit more objectively dangerous. There's definitely been some, when you're reading Chris Bonington's books, sadly it was almost every expedition, there was almost one climber that was killed on them. And I think climbing is a dangerous sport. I mean, for me, I think that's one of the reasons why I haven't been as successful as I could have been with mountain trips I've been on. I'm not willing to push it that little bit extra further that some people are. I don't know. Yeah, I think you hear that some people kind of say that a mountain's worth dying for. To me, it's just that's not a cat and hell's chance. No way. You know, we're climbing mountains. It's great fun. It's a great personal achievement. We're not, you're not out there saving lives or anything. It is just climbing. It's fun. It's great. It inspires people to do it. And I get a lot of personal satisfaction from it. But I don't think my risk acceptance levels are as big as some people. So that's probably one of the reasons I haven't been, I don't know. I'd call myself successful because I'm still here and I've had fun doing what I've been doing, but yeah, maybe why I haven't got up as many things as what I've tried. And yeah, it is, unfortunately, is that, you are putting yourself in dangerous situations. You try and minimize it, but when you get out in the Himalayas on the big faces, if you're trying a new route, there's always going to be sections where you are under that serac for a couple of pitches, or you are in that big snowball. There's no way to avoid it. We try and, you spend ages trying to pick the safest line, or trying the line with the least objective hazard. But unfortunately, there is always going to be that one little bit, and you use your judgment and your experience to assess whether it's, is it safeness, is it justifiable risk? And it's just the nature of the sport, I guess. But you're just trying to avoid all those objective hazards as much as you can.
From your position today, where you are now, with the knowledge you have, with the experience you have, and also with the network and the kind of the friends that you surround yourself with when it comes to the alpine world, the climbing world, I'm sure that you unfortunately probably know a lot of people that's not with us today because they have been lost in the mountains. Do you think if you compare yourself now to maybe when you started, like, dreaming about this, or when you started climbing, do you think your thoughts and views on, like, death and mortality, has it changed over the years in some way?
I don't know, because you never go out thinking you're going to die. Or,
of course not.
You never go out thinking I might not come back. Mm. You know, if I'm starting up a route and I think I might not come back, then that's the time you turn around. I don't think of it like that. But definitely, unfortunately, I've lost quite a few close friends in the mountains. And it does, I think, it brings a realization home. You know it's a dangerous sport, but then as you slowly get more and more into it, and you hear of people and you know people who've been lost in the mountains, it brings it home that how dangerous it is. And then you kind of think, well, is it really worth it? Because I say, it's great fun, it's amazing, but it is just climbing at the end of the day. And it does, but life's about having fun, isn't it? So, we can't ask those people if it's worth it. I'm sure they hopefully think it is, but I think it just brings the reality home that it is quite a dangerous sport. And you just got to try and maximise the safety. When I first close friend I lost to climbing, it hit me a lot harder. You hear of people being killed, but it's until you actually know someone personally that you suddenly, it can happen to me. Mm. It's like any illnesses and stuff.
Get hit by a bus.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's the thing. You've got to live life for today. Yeah. I'm a strong believer in that as well. Mm. And you've got to, and as long as you're out there having fun, that's the main thing. But everybody's idea of fun's different, isn't it?
Doing what you do, of course, it has taken a lot of time and energy, and it takes a lot of time away from other things, I guess. Now you're not a full-time climber, you've got a normal job in the family business, but do you feel that, would you say that you have had to sacrifice anything along the way in order to pursue these dreams that you have?
Yeah, whether sacrifice is the right word, because I've wanted to pursue the dreams.
That's true. It's not perhaps poor choice of words.
Yeah, it's a choice. It's not like I've had to join national service and go fight for my country. I'm not. It's not something I've had to do against my free will. I've chosen to make them. So, whether sacrifice is the right word, I don't know. But definitely missed out on. I don't know, I haven't missed out because I've had these amazing adventures. Oh. So I've been lucky with work. So I've been lucky that I can work in the family business. So I've been able to go leave work for a couple of months to go on an expedition and come back into the job. So I guess if I didn't have, if I wasn't fortunate to have that, I would maybe have, my career would have, wouldn't it be, you know, if I was a career-driven person, it wouldn't have been as successful, you could say, I don't know. Have I sacrificed anything else? I think I've, you know, I don't think I really have. It's hard. It's quite a different, interesting question, that, actually, yeah. Isn't it? Because, I mean, you know, for example, I remember once I had a holiday booked to go over my mate's sport climbing in Spain, and the conditions on the Grand Jurass came in really good. And it's like, if you don't live in the Alps, but you want to get some of the classic routes done, you've got to be able to just make those decisions. So, yeah, I phoned a mate, said, oh, yeah, it was the Colton Max in really good condition. Sure, yeah, yeah, I'm meant to be in Spain, but my mates will understand, I'm sure. And, yeah, so that was, yeah, instead of going to Spain, I went, we just flew out to the Alps and did some, you know, climbed an amazing route on the Grand Jurass. And so they're not sacrificed, but I think you've got to be prepared to make adjustments to, if you don't actually live in the mountains, to actually get stuff done.
Perhaps adjustments is a better choice of words than sacrifice.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's not like I haven't got any children, so I haven't missed growing up with my kids or anything like that by being away for a month at a time in the mountains or anything like that. And I'm in a fortunate position with work that I can take the extended time off to go do the trip, so I haven't had to sacrifice a career for it either or anything.
The steps from climbing to alpinism, how did that work for you? I mean, do you think it was always about alpinism for you?
Yeah.
Or did that, so it was kind of a natural progress, or was it kind of that you rediscovered something or that you discovered something that made you go into the alpinism?
No, I think for me, alpinism was always the end game. I'd read all these books, like we were saying earlier. And I think for me, getting into climbing was a stepping stone to get to the Alps and eventually to the greater ranges. I never didn't expect it to happen, but I think it was definitely, I enjoyed the mountains, I enjoyed climbing, and the two go, you know, alpinism was the natural progression. So I think I did a very traditional British introduction to it. You know, I started rock climbing, started going to Scotland in the winter, went to the Alps in the summer, went to the Alps in the winter, and then eventually to the greater ranges. So yeah, I think my end game, so to speak, you know, my end goal was always to get into alpinism from starting climbing. Reading the books. I think it was Joe Tasker's book, This Game of Ghosts, about living, you know, 10 of them crammed in a flat in Chamonix type thing, and just, you know, spending the winters in Chamonix. I just found that really, really interesting, and I think I always wanted to get into alpinism.
How would you describe your Chamonix? Your take on Chamonix. Your thoughts on Chamonix.
My thoughts on Chamonix. It's a big adventure playground. It's an amazing place, and I think I've spent 5 or 6 winters there. I've never lived there full time, but I've spent a lot of time, you know, doing the airport transfer driving, the usual jobs that people do to make it work out there. I had one winter where I just worked really hard all summer, saved up, and went out and just climbed for a full winter, did a few odd jobs whilst I was there. But no, Chamonix is good. It's a strange place. It's an interesting place, and I've got a lot of my best friends live there, and I don't spend as much time there as I used to, and I really do miss it quite a lot. Not Chamonix specifically, but just the people there and the access to the mountains for training, you know, just for training and things like that. It's an amazing place. I don't think there's anywhere else like it in the world where you can have such easy access to the mountains. I was there last summer for a quick visit. I went up with a mate. We got the first Telefreak up to the plan. Did the Frendo Spur, which is sort of 1,000 meter, fairly straightforward north face route, but really good fun. And then we were back down in Chamonix got the lift back down. I think we were back down by 11 o'clock in the morning having brunch, which there's not many places in the world where you can
commute to the
adventure. You can do a north face in the morning and be back down. Yeah, okay, it's the north face thing. It's not on the big classic north face, but still, it's a really cool, fun outing. And it's a pretty fun place. For me, there wasn't really any work I could do in Chamonix. I had my ties when I work back at home, which, although I kept trying to, I thought I wanted to live in Chamonix, I always kept getting drawn back home, and I tried to make it work, you know, doing my work at home in Chamonix, but that just wasn't going to happen, unfortunately. So for me, it's a difficult, I think, unless you're a guide or you've got your own business that you can run from Chamonix, it's, you know, to actually have a career where you can make the most of the mountains, it's quite a difficult one to do. To me, Chamonix will always be a special place, and you know, I'm sure I'm gonna have friends that will be living there all the time, so it has been and it still will be a big part of my life, and I'd like to get back to be able to spend a bit more time out there, which is the plan in the future.
When it comes to alpinism, if you were forced to kind of put into words the, like, your philosophy on it or the emotions that you have about it, that, like, what it is with alpinism that attracts you, what it is with alpinism that keeps you there?
Yeah, I think it's I don't think there's one specific thing. I think it's just for me, it's the whole draw. It's the whole package almost. It's the being out in the mountains, experiencing your nature in its rawest form. And I was looking at some of the photos I was showing last night from Linxar, and some of the sunsets and the natural light and the natural beauty that we got to experience, and it makes you feel very humble that you've been there to experience that. And I think combine that with climbing and challenging yourself physically and mentally, which is a big part for me, and exploring the unknowns on climb peaks, and that, and combining that with being with one of your best mates doing it.
Yeah.
It's just the whole package that's involved. And it's just good fun. It's just really good fun. I don't know. it's a strange one. I know alpine climbing isn't everybody's cup of tea, but it's hard trying to explain to someone who's not into it what the draw is in it, because, you know, it's cold, it's miserable at times, but you know, when you get a North Face in really good condition and you just romp up it really fast, it's just good fun. And it's, you know, combining all your skills of climbing into one thing, and
kind of the mental part of it and the
I think alpine climbing, and especially when you're on a route for a few days, the mental side is way more important than what people think. I'm certainly not the fittest climber out there, but I think what I discovered when I first got into climbing, I didn't mind pushing myself. And I think the head game in alpine climbing is just so important. Being able to, your body's feeling completely depleted, you're feeling completely down. Excuse the French, you're feeling just fucked. But being able to tell yourself that you can carry on, that there's that barrier and go, you know, where your head's saying, nah, stop now. But you know you've got it in you to carry on. And it is, when you're on a face for like 5 days, it's a big, big, big mental battle to keep the motivation up to keep going and stuff. And it's just, it's mind games.
And I heard other people like saying about being on exposed terrain like that, is the thought of, I shouldn't be able to be here, but
yeah.
I am.
Yeah.
The kind of a surreal feeling to it, and yeah. I guess that is something that you think of as well.
It's like kind of saying back to the sunsets, that, you know, we're digging into the side of a mountain at 6,800 meters. You've got the whole Karakoram just bathed in that blood red sunlight, and it's like I shouldn't. Not once when I was growing up did I ever think I'd be able to be in this position to experience that. And you know, you think how few people have actually managed, you feel very lucky, because it's not every day you get to experience that sort of thing, and the exposure, and like you say, it's like humans weren't designed to be up there. It's not your natural progression, and you know, you kids go play football and cricket or whatever, but yeah, you suddenly find yourself, wow, this is pretty special, and very lucky to have the opportunity, because you've got to remember, not everybody has the opportunity to do this, not because of the money side or the trip, but just, you know, where you grow up and the life, we live in the modern world, and we should take it for granted. You know, we shouldn't take it for granted that we have the ability to go on these trips, we have the ability to travel for, without any restrictions on us, borders and stuff. And yeah, I think suddenly when you strip it back to that, you realise that there's people who are fighting for lives because of famine or whatever, and then, you know, we're there just having this amazing time. It's suddenly like, well, actually, we're very lucky to be able to do it in the first place, let alone actually experience it. It's
I can imagine that it's kind of a mind-boggling thought as well, that the fact that you're probably, well, especially on Lingxia, that you were probably like the first people in the planet's history to ever touch these rocks and to ever...
Yeah.
That's got to...
But I think that's...
It's got to play a role as well.
Yeah, and it's the same on, I think, yeah, I think that's the that was the draw to Lingxia for definitely for John and for myself. It's the unknowns. And I think that's the whole draw of trying new routes out in the greater ranges. It's nothing's guaranteed. You know, your chances of success is minute. I'm sure a statistician or a mathematician can work out some complicated equation to give you a percentage figure, but there's just so much against you in the first place. So that's the chat. You know, not having a guaranteed outcome is the first thing that I think draws you there. It's the, you know, you're taking your chances of against the weather, the conditions, everything. And it's just the unknown. You don't know what's going to be around the next corner. You know, with Lingxia especially, we couldn't see the mountain from anywhere. We didn't know what the summit ridge was like. Unfortunately, we still don't know what the summit ridge is like because we didn't get to have a go at it. But yeah, it's that just pitching yourself against the mountain, and it's, you know, you and your mate, a rope, start the bomb, try and get to the top. And just it's that knowing you've got the skill to overcome what you'll find, but not knowing what you're going to find, if you get me. And then, yeah, it's just the unknowns about it.
Could you describe the lure and attraction of type 2 fun?
Type 2 fun.
What is, yeah, type 2 fun?
Type 2 fun. I think that's the term we use to try and convince ourselves we actually enjoyed what we did. Like, yeah, there's definitely times when you're climbing, you're hating it. You know, you've got hot aches in your hands and feet, and you're thinking, why am I not just into beach holidays, sitting back with my girlfriend, having enjoyed a nice cold beer on the beach? But yeah, type 2 fun is when you get down and you reflect on what you've done.
That actually was fun.
It actually was. Maybe at times, there were times of it that weren't fun, but the whole thing, the reward I guess some people say it's almost like a drug. I don't think it's like in a drug, whether it's the addiction, but just the adrenaline and the buzz you get from it, to, yeah, whether you've done. And I think I'm maybe mellowing a bit because now I get that same buzz if I just go out and do a really classic, easy route and enjoy it, and it's fun at the time. I get almost as much of a buzz from that now as I do from trying a really hard route and maybe having a bit of a not as fun time on it. But yeah, the type 2 fun is, I think it's what we convince ourselves to make us go back again. But no, it is, you know, there are times you're not going to enjoy every minute of it. Times where it's pretty miserable and you get scared. I get scared.
Yeah.
And I think it's getting scared is what keeps you alive as well. It's that, you know, it's not having that blasé confidence to just go. It's
kind of your spider.
It's that reality check. It's that little thing on, little, yeah, voice in the back of your head that tells you, now just think about this.
But where are your limits when it comes to the being uncomfortable and being, I don't know, cold and scared? Like, can you handle cold, for instance? Is that a big obstacle for you? Well, obviously not.
I think it's not. Yeah, obviously the cold's a limiting factor, but you dress accordingly. But I think that stems back to that mental game that we were talking about earlier. It's, yeah, you get cold, you get scared, but it's being able to push yourself a bit beyond that, especially with the actual conditions. But I think with the being scared bit, that's there for a reason, and it's up to you how far you push that. Other, you know, people like to push themselves a bit further than others for being scared. But when you say to coming over overcoming the cold, yeah, there is a physical limit on the cold. It's, yeah, there are. It's not, you can't just keep pushing it, otherwise you are going to get hypothermia, or you're going to lose your fingers, you're going to lose your toes. So I think things like cold, there is a physical limit of what you're capable of, and that's down that. But that's also down to equipment and how you prepare the equipment you've prepared for the trip, and it's taking the right equipment to the right climb, if that makes sense. You know, taking the right boots, not taking your summer boots on a on a winter alpine climb and things like that. So yeah, but I think you can put a physical limit on that side of things, but the being scared, I think that's more of a mental limit, and how far you're willing to push it, and each person's perception of that is their own. And I think it's important when you've got a climbing partnership that you don't try and push your partner past what their acceptance level of being scared is, because otherwise they're definitely not going to have fun. And you're probably not going to be talking when you get down.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
These experiences of pushing yourself and willingly exposing yourself to being uncomfortable, do you think that this works as a tool to kind of, does that affect your view on the comforts of modern society? That's a big mouthful.
Yeah, no, I see where you're going with it. I think I enjoy both. I like modern comforts as well.
yeah, of course. But maybe do you think you enjoy it even more now that you know what it's like to stay away a month on?
Yeah, I think it's. I mean, when you come back, it's strange. When you go away for a trip and you're away for maybe 2 months, one of the thing often you this will be to Nepal or Pakistan, and I know it sounds really stupid. But one of the best things of coming back is turning the tap on and having a glass of cold water straight out the tap, which is something we just take for granted day in, day out.
But that was exactly where I was going at.
But you suddenly, you know, out there, you've got to drink bottled water, you've got to boil it, you can't drink the water out the taps. And you're having a shower, for example, you've got to make sure you're in the shower and you don't, you know, once you get back to Kathmandu, don't breathe it, don't drink it, don't swallow any of the water in the shower. And it's just I think it's the simple things like that you suddenly appreciate massively. But I think because we're that used to them, you maybe appreciate it for a week when you get back from the trip, and then you're just back to taking it for granted. Right. But yeah, no, it definitely does make you, and I think that's one of the things I look forward to most coming back, is just turning the cold tap on and having a, it's like you don't have to drink a boil water and to sterilise it and then let it cool to get a cold drink. You just, but yeah, no, it does make you appreciate it. But I think, unfortunately, as a society in the West, we're so used to those modern comforts, you soon just slip back into just accepting them as normal again, and you forget. But it is, the whole travelling to the likes of Nepal and Pakistan, it is.
Adds perspective, I guess.
Yeah, it adds perspective to life in general, I think. You know, I just had an average middle class upbringing in Yorkshire. Parents worked really hard. And, you know, I didn't have a super privileged life, but if we needed stuff, there was the ability to have what was needed. There was never excess, but it was just, you know, we never went hungry for food or anything like that. We just had an average, middle class upbringing, and I think it's very humbling then to go out, and it just makes you realise that actually, you know, it's, wow, there's a big disparity in the world.
Yeah, from a global perspective, you cannot complain about anything.
No, I can't. Yeah, we try to, and we do, but at the end of the day, we can't. Oh. And it was really interesting, the last trip to Pakistan, we had this really nice cook, a guy called Sakat, and he was also, often the cooks that we have at base camp, they don't speak that much English, so you can kind of communicate a little bit, you know, you can have a very basic one, but you can't, because they're from the local villages, they haven't learned, you know, English, and I can't speak their local language, unfortunately. But Sakawa had, he'd worked in a lot of restaurants. He was from the local area, from a proper traditional, very, just a traditional Pakistani village upbringing. but he'd worked in a lot of restaurants in the big cities, and he spoke really good English. Mm-hmm. So it was really interesting to be actually sit down and have conversations and learn about his upbringing and what it was like to grow up in a small village. And he was telling us that, you know, I can't remember exactly, maybe 10 brothers and sisters he had. But and just as if it's normal, he said, yeah, four of my brothers died whilst they were road builders, and four have died in the process. And he just said it like, I'd say to you, yeah, I tripped over and sprained my ankle under that run the other day. And it, suddenly you realise that, wow, life, yeah, it's a very different reality out there. And it was really interesting to actually be able to speak to him and learn a lot about it from, you know, a lot of the people out there who can speak English, like the liaison officers, have had a very privileged lifestyle for that area. So it was really, really, really interesting to get to know what it was really like to grow up in a small village out there.
But do you ever, in that moment or in a situation like that, and now, please don't get me wrong, but do you ever feel like a big asshole? Like, because you come from this privileged background and you just go there just for fun?
Yeah.
But then again, of course, I mean, I don't mean it like that, because of course you bring money and work job opportunity for them and so on. And it's not like, but what you said earlier, it's not like you're going on a medical expedition or something. But do you ever get those feelings, and how do you handle it? How do you cope with it?
You get the feelings. I think we've actively made that choice to go knowing that, so you can't, you feel bad about it, but I guess you justify it that we are bringing work to the local area and helping them. And definitely in Pakistan, they need a lot more of people, tourism, to help the local economy for the, you know, they're all subsistence farmers, a lot of them, and their only cash is from portering or cooking for expeditions. But yeah, no, you've hit the nail on the head. You know, we're going on this mountain having this really hard time suffering. And, you know, these guys are just, well, you're on your holiday. Don't complain too much. You know, we're sat around in base camp complaining the weather's not good. And it's like,
they just lost half their family.
Yeah, and it's just, you suddenly, it does make, yeah, it puts, like we were saying, it just puts it in perspective, doesn't it? And I think as long as you're not too blasé about it, it's good. Mm. But they're psyched to see you. They know you're bringing money into the area. And they're genuinely really nice people, usually, in the mountain. When you get to meet the people in the mountains, whether it's Nepal, Pakistan, in Peru, wherever, they are, I'm sure there's a bit of, they're putting the show on because they want to be nice, to keep you coming back, but when they are, I've always been made to feel so welcome in these places, and it's, I don't think, hopefully they don't begrudge us being there. I don't know, it'd be interesting to see, but maybe they just, I think they don't just look at us as a way to earn a living. I think they're excited that people are coming to see their country as well.
Mm. It's an interesting
perspective. Yeah, no, but I know what you mean. It's just these people are struggling for life, just working every hour of the day to survive, not to save up to go on a holiday. Just they're just trying to survive, and but to be honest, they're pretty happy, and that's the other reality check. You know, the kids are just running around in the muck, messing about with each other, having a laugh. They couldn't be happier. They're not sat on an iPad. Staring at the TV or collecting Pokemons there. And okay, they're going out with a lot of things, but you kind of, if you strip it back to the raw basics, who's the happiest? And I know there's a lot of situations that make their, that would make, they do have a lot of very difficult situations, but when you actually just look at the kids out there, they don't know any different, and they are just very different to seeing kids playing over here. They're just having a laugh with the mates, and it's interesting.
Going back to what you started talking about, camaraderie and friendship in when it comes to alpinism, but you always go climbing with people that are, because I can imagine either you go climbing with only with people that are really good, that you know, that you love spending time with down from the mountain, like off the mountain, but I can also imagine that sometimes even though you have the good friends in the city or on the flats.
Yeah.
That doesn't necessarily
make it. It's not going to
work. That doesn't necessarily make it a good match in the mountains. And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think you get, I've got friends that do a whole array of sports. I've got friends that don't climb that I like spending as much time with as I do friends that climb. And I think as you progress through climbing, you get to meet not progress, but as you get more involved in climbing, you meet people, and you meet people at a similar level to you. You get your friends that you get on with, and then you talk about going away. So you're naturally going away with your friends, I guess. So that most of my expeditions have been with two people, Nick Bullock and John Griffith. Both, you know, love them both to bits. I had some great times with both, and yeah, we're lucky we can climb at similar levels. Great climber, Nick's, is really, really good climber. So if it's a hard pitch, you just send Nick up it. And the same with John. John's just so fit in the mountains. It's a perfect partnership. And yeah, I guess it's probably through the climbing that they've become such good friends. You know, I wouldn't have met them if it wasn't for climbing. So yeah, it's not like I'm just going away with my best mate who I grew up with, because yeah, we wouldn't step foot on the mountain. But I guess it's just you've just learned that you appreciate time with them, and you can spend time with them, and yeah.
But it is important for you that you know them for a long time, like before strapping in.
Yeah.
Because the way I understood it is that is not always the case.
No.
In many expeditions, you kind of get teamed up you team up with people that you know of. Perhaps you've met them.
Yeah.
But it is very kind of like a business project, sort of.
Yeah, I don't know. For me, no. I never class it as a business project. For me, it's you've got to go away with someone you want to go away with. I think it depends on what sort of expedition you look at. If you're going on about, say, if you had a team, a group of climbers from the same sponsor, and they went away on a rock climbing trip, that would be really good fun.
Yeah.
But I think going away on a big alpine trip where you're
portal edge,
you've got to have complete trust. You're not just doing a multi-pitch couple of pitches of rock climbing. You've got to have complete trust in your partner, and I think that's another reason for only going away with people that you know how they think, you know how they operate in the mountains, you know you've got similar levels of risk acceptance. You know you're not going to have someone who's just a complete wild card who's going to risk, want to push it. So yeah, for me, you've got to go away with something you've climbed with before or that you know personally, and you spend a lot of downtime in base camp, you know. And yeah, I worked out one year. I think I spent a quarter of the year away living in a base camp with Nick. So you've got to. We did two trips one year, and we spent a lot of that time sharing a tent. Yeah, we're not the same tent in base camp, but just in close proximity. It's like when you get to know someone really well. Silences aren't awkward, if that makes sense. You don't have to make polite conversation. If one of you doesn't feel like chatting that day, it doesn't feel awkward that you're not talking or you're reading your own books, if that does that make sense.
So how about
the
weather?
Yeah, how's the weather out? Yeah, the weather's really good today, isn't it? Yeah. And I think that's important because you spend a lot, you can't, you want your own time as well. And
but do you ever turn down offers of expeditions or being turned down?
I'm not good enough to be offered to go. I think I'm not a world leading alpinist that's going to get offers to go on expeditions. I climb for myself and I just climb my mates, and yeah, we try cool stuff, and that's what it's about. So I wouldn't ever offer to go away. I wouldn't approach someone who I didn't know to go away on a trip in the first place. And I don't think I'd get approached by people I don't know, if that makes sense. I'm just, for me, it's about going away with the guys you do know. And it's, you know, I did a lot of climbing with Nick over the last 10 years. We spent a lot of time in Chamonix together. And you get into that sort of partnership where you don't have to question each other. And I think that's really important. You know that, you know, someone's, if you're moving together on quite technical ground, you know if it gets too bad, he's going to stop and put a belay in, rather than risking it. Or if there's a decision to make on which way to go, I'll trust his judgment, and you know, I won't question it, and he knows I won't question it, and vice versa. If I'm leading and I'm trying to decide whether to take that goulot, that couloir, or that rib, I'll make the decision, and we won't question each other's judgment, say, oh, you've gone the wrong way. And that's really important, I think. Just not almost second-guessing, but just being happy with the other person's decision without having to second-guess it or rethink it. And that's a special partnership for sure.
You're a part of the North Face team now. What does that mean, like, for your career?
For my career. That? So I guess I don't look at climbing as being my career as such. I've got my career I climb a...
Your passion.
My passion, yeah, it's definitely my passion, and I'm very fortunate to work with the North Face to help fulfill some of those dreams and those trips. They're great. Yeah, the guys we work with in the UK and the European team, they're very supportive and understanding, and for me personally, they also understand that I'm not a full-time climber and that I do have a life outside of climbing, so I can't commit as much to them as some of the other athletes, but at the same time I'm not asking for as much back, I guess. But it's given, you know, obviously financially wise for trips, they've helped support a number of my trips. You get the kit, and also you get to meet some really cool people as well. I've never actually been away climbing with any of the guys I know from the North Face team, just because I've got my climbing partners I climb with already, and I guess that maybe brings back to what we were talking about earlier. Although I'm part of the North Face team, and full of some of the world's best climbers, I don't know the guys that well, so I climb with my mates that I enjoy climbing. But it's good. It's we were at the Mountain Festival the other week and hanging out with the other European athletes. They're such a good, chilled bunch of people. They're really good fun to hang out with. And it's definitely given me some opportunities for trips. I've done more trips than I would have done without the support, that's for sure. But at the same time, we're very lucky in the UK that we've got, there's a good grant system to help climbers go away on expeditions. We've got the Mount Everest Foundation, the Nick Escort grant, the BMC supply grant. So I think in the UK, we're, as someone trying to get into alpine climbing, we're very fortunate that for young people that you can apply for these grants and funding to help go away on your first trips. And most of my trips have been heavily supported by these like charitable grants, and not every country has that. I think in the UK, it's sadly a lot of the grants are in place in memory of climbers that have been killed in the mountains. But it definitely gives you a lot of opportunities, and working with the North Face has just made it a lot easier to, I can come up with a trip, an idea, and it's made it a lot easier to fulfil that. But by no means has it put pressure on me to do trips, which is good. I think this, you can't have a commercial pressure to go do these sort of expeditions, if that makes sense. And they realise that when they support a trip, they know it's not a guaranteed success. A lot of questions you get asked is, hey, do you feel pressure from your sponsors? And the straight answer is no. I've never had a sponsor that's put pressure on me to do something I don't want to do.
You get a call from Conrad Anker and hey, I got this summit scoped out for you. You need to finish this.
I think that's full respect to the companies I work with. There's never any pressure to push yourself.
Speaking about pushing yourself, you got a lot of attention for the Link SAR project. How would you describe Link SAR? The mountain, the climate, the nature, the surroundings. What is that? It's the Karakoram.
Yeah, it's in the Karakoram, in
northern Pakistan.
Yeah,
bordering China and Afghanistan.
Close to India. Yeah, so it's in a valley called the Charakusa. Link SAR, I don't know why. I think the attention it gets helps from John's photos, definitely. Like, John is an amazing photographer as well as being an amazing alpinist. There's always going to be amazing photos when we come back from a trip with John. So that definitely helps the attention. But Link SAR is it's a really cool mountain in the Charakusa. And the Charakusa is probably one of the more climbed out valleys in the Karakoram. There's been a lot, it's K7, K6 that have seen a lot of attempts, and there's been a lot of lower climbs done, very technical climbing done in that area. But for some reason, Link SAR still remained unclimbed. It's a weird mountain. It's hidden away right in the back corner, so you can't actually see it from anywhere. Often when you're in a base camp, you camp below your mountain, and you can actually see and scope the route for a... And that, it's a really important part, is scoping the route to figure out where the natural ice falls are, where if there's an avalanche, where the run out is. But Link SAR was very different. We couldn't actually see the face we were going to climb until we were right under it. And that involved an approach up a really gnarly glacier. So you didn't want to just go up there. It was too dangerous to go up there and hang out for fun. So yeah, it was really interesting. It's a very complex mountain, and there was our idea was to try and climb the northwest face to the west summit, and then there was about a kilometre long ridge at just under 7,000 meters to then get to the main summit, which was only sort of like 100 meters higher than the west summit, but was a kilometre away, and it looked like it was going to have some really quite technical climbing on it, and I think that was the it's kind of like a stepping stone for me and John. It was seeing if we were capable of that technical climbing at that altitude. So it was really, we had an amazing time on Lynxar. We didn't achieve what we set out to achieve, which was the to get to the main summit. We only got to the west summit, but still we classed it as a really successful trip because it both physically, mentally, just the journey, everything involved in it. John got
and you
really,
came back.
And we came back. Yeah, came back. And I was trying to in the last night when we were chatting about Lynxar at the shop. I was trying to say, was it a success? And because John and I got down, we'd had a great. And we thought, well, we didn't make the main summit, but yeah, it was still a success. Hey, we came back, had an amazing sight experience of 7 days in the mountains with my mate. What the mountain threw at us, and we, you know, John got really ill with fever at site, nearly just under 7,000 meters, which was just. Yeah, which was really, really, that was quite, just, I've never had such a feeling of helplessness. And, you know, I think for me, the thing about climbing is as long as you're honest about what you've done and how you've done it, and if you're going out there having fun in the mountains, it's a success. And I think that's the key is you've got to be honest about what you've done. Yeah, we did actually want to climb the main summit. We didn't achieve that, but we got to the west summit and had a good time. Rather than just suddenly, oh, we only got to the west summit, we better say that was our original goal. Then it was, you know, it wasn't our original goal, but it was good. It was good fun.
And this was not the first time that you were on the mountain.
No, this was my second time. It was John's fourth time. So John had tried it. I tried it once before with me. He tried it with Will Sim back in 2012. Tried it with myself in 2013. I got really ill on that trip, unfortunately. I think I'd already set off with a bit not as well as I thought I was. It turns out I'd got a post-viral fatigue from a virus earlier in the year, and I didn't really notice it until I was really pushing myself physically. And that smacked me for about a year and a bit. I didn't really, just really blew my confidence, actually, because you're not used to sight, your body letting you down. I mean, as I use the term athlete in inverted commas, as an athlete, you're used to your body working. So to suddenly have it, you're being shut down by your body is quite, it really blew my confidence actually for a while. So I took a bit of a while to get over and get fitness back. But then John went back in 2014 with Kevin Mahoney and tried it again, but got some really bad weather. And then we went back in 2015 and got to the West Summit. But
about going back to a kind of an unfinished project, couldn't that be, isn't always, I mean, it's good, of course, in the sense that you know what to expect, but isn't it a problematic side of it as well, that you might put yourself in the risk of,
yeah,
oh, we've put so much effort in, we put so much time in, we've done all of this, so we can't turn back now, and we need to finish this now. And
yeah, definitely. And I'd say we maybe fell foul of that a bit on Lynxar,
because that's kind of a one of the definitions of summit fever.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And we probably when John got ill, when we hit the ridge line at about 6,800 meters, so it was obvious we weren't going to get to the main summit. Then to me, it was like, the first night John got ill, it was like, right, how the hell am I going to get John off the mountain? I just assumed he was going to be deteriorate through the night. In the morning, he was a bit better. We spent a full day there, and he got a bit stronger and a bit stronger. And the sensible decision would definitely to have been to go straight down the next day. But the West Summit was just, we knew it was so close and definitely reachable. We'd done all the hard climbing. It was just quite an involved ridge, but it was definitely reachable. So we decided to carry on and get even higher, which with John in the state he was, probably wasn't the wisest decision. So maybe that was summit fever a little bit, But at the same time, I think we both knew we were pushing the boundaries at an acceptable level for us. We weren't going up ground we couldn't reverse. The sensible thing, given everything, would to be go straight down whilst John was still fit and well enough to get down, because who knows what would happen if we went higher up. And luckily we went higher up. His fever did return that evening, but he was good enough. Yeah, he was fine to get down.
And you knew that you still had the weather window,
and we knew still had the weather window, and we knew that was our last weather window. So yeah, that was a little bit of summit fever, but at the same time, we didn't carry on over the ridge to the main summit, because we knew that was just as much as we'd like to, being able to stare at it and think, oh, it's... It was still miles, a kilometre away, but so close, it felt so close. We knew that wasn't an option, so summit fever didn't take off there. But going back to the whole Linkstar thing, and you say it received quite a lot of attention, because I think predominantly because of a lot of John's photos are absolutely amazing of it. Linkstar had seen no attention for a lot of years, and then this year there were four teams trying it.
Wow.
And I think that shows what the internet does nowadays, how easy information is to get out there, and people see stuff that everybody else is trying and get ideas. But yeah, apparently there were four teams to try Linkstar this year.
But they have none have summited so far?
They got really bad weather. British guy Tom Ballard, they got to about 6,800 metres, I think it was 6,800 they got to, but got caught in weather again. It's then that's the thing with Pakistan, it's trying to get the weather.
So what month did you do this? Was it springtime?
We're in July, I think. It was July. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We walked out on my birthday, so yeah, it was July.
but these four teams, they're kind of following your lead?
No, two were trying it from a different side. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure where the other guys would, what line the other guys were trying.
You think you will return?
I don't think so to Linkstar. There's two... Linkstar is one trip in a lot of amazing trips I've had. I know we're chatting about it now because it's the most recent. But to me, there's too many places to go and visit.
Yeah.
I know I'm not going to do expedition climbing for the rest of my life. I know the motivation for it will. I'm not one of these people that's going to want to carry on doing these trips till I'm 65. Yeah, I hope I'm still doing trips when I'm 65, but it'll be not every year in, year out. So to me, there's so many places to visit. I went back to Linkstar twice. There's other mountains I've been back to twice, but I think after two times, I want to go try somewhere new, because that's what it's all about. It's about visiting different areas as well. The reaching the summit is the main reason we're there, but it's also nice to experience the cultures and see the other different areas. So yeah, I'd like to go back to India. I think I'm planning maybe try and get to India this next year. We'll see.
You were nominated for Piolet d'Or.
Yeah.
In 2010.
Yeah.
How does that work? I mean, do you get nominated as a person or as an expedition?
It's an expedition route. Okay, myself and Nick got nominated for that for a climb we did on Chang Himal, which was really...
How did that feel? Like being nominated? First weird. The project and also the...
Yeah, like the climbing was... you don't set out to get nominated by... But I think... For me, I never dreamed I'd get nominated for a Piolet d'Or. And climbing, we don't climb for awards. We climb it for our own personal satisfaction. But I think it was just a lot of people, there were some really influential people who I respected on the jury that year. So to have what we've done acknowledged by them almost was quite special. The award side, to me, it wasn't important, but... It is a nice feeling to have something you've done recognised by your peers. It is a nice feeling. There's no two ways about it. The Chang Himal was brilliant. That was my second trip to the Greater Range, second proper trip to the Great to Nepal. I'd been the previous year with Nick, and we'd had our base camp completely robbed. So we didn't do any climbing.
Really?
Yeah, we'd. It was in 2008, I think. Nick and I went to try a mountain called Peak 41. We were doing it really on the cheap, so we didn't have a base camp. We had the permits, and we paid for the permits for Pete and done everything correct that way, but we were trying to do it super cheap, so we didn't take a cook with us or anything. We just had some quarters. Unmanned base camp, and we just set it up in this really small little valley away from the main valley. And I think, I'm not sure if the locals maybe thought we were trying to do it illegally because we didn't, or they were a bit begrudged because we hadn't employed any local cooks and stuff. Yeah. But we had permits and everything. Mm. But yeah, we'd been up, we'd acclimatized on a little trekking peak nearby, gone back to the base camp. And then we'd gone down the valley just to rest at a low altitude at one of the tea houses for a couple of days before going back up to then try Peak 41. And we got back up and they'd just taken everything. So we'd gone down with a little rucksack with, you know, taking a sleeping bag and a down jacket and the books down to this tea house to rest for a couple of days. And went, so we'd left everything in the tents, two tents. And we got back up and they'd just taken the tents down and taken every single bit of kit we had. It was just like, wow, I guess that's a trip over then. Which was really, it was really sad actually, because it was my first time in Nepal and I'd heard amazing things about Nepal and the Nepalese. Mm. And it was just like, oh, right, so this is what I... But you know, it's like everywhere. There's a few bad apples.
Of course.
Everywhere. Yeah. And yeah, I don't know why they did it. I think it was a bit, they maybe thought we were doing it legally. They thought we maybe they begrudged us because we weren't employing the locals, but you know. So yeah, we walked in with, I think, four or six porters and then walked out with just a little rucksack each a few days later. But they literally took everything, took the tents down, took all our mountain bags, all the food. They left all our rubbish. But luckily we had some friends climbing in the area, so we asked them to send their, they sent two of their porters over to grab all our rubbish and carry that out for us, because we didn't have any way of getting rid of it.
Shoving it in your head.
Yeah. So we can't. So we walked out very frustrated from that.
Light and fast.
Yeah, that was light and fast walk. Some very. Let's just say I'm glad we didn't see anybody carrying our bags, because I think I'd have been holding Nick back by the scruff of his neck. But yeah, so the year after we went back to Nepal and had a much, much better trip. Mm. A beautiful mountain called Changi Mal, which was just, that was my first new route, my first proper new route. And it was just this plumb line straight up this north face, and it was just a dream. It was amazing. It's one of those trips that just went really well. And we got there, we had a really good time at base camp. Some friends walked in with us that were doing some trekking in the area. And yeah, just started at the bottom, climbed to the top. Amazing new route.
Took a selfie,
yeah, took the obligatory summit selfie. And it was just one of those trips that just went well, which... the most memorable for the achievement, but sometimes they're not the most memorable because you haven't had that epic on it or something. You know, yeah, there were a few moments on it for sure, you know, but it was just brilliant. And it maybe gave me a bit of a false idea of what climbing in the Himalayas was like. I was like, oh, this is great. You just rock up and you climb a new route. But yeah, that was an amazing experience, Changi Mal. And the line was to just climb, it was the perfect line on a mountain. It's a beautiful, pointy mountain. And we climbed straight up the centre of the North Face. Some really good climbing on it. And we had really good weather. And yeah, got down, the weather broke just as we got down. And yeah, got a really cool photo of me and Nick just sat at the bottom of the face when we've just spent full day descending. Just the grins just say all. Yeah, so that was a really... And yeah, we were fortunate to get nominated for the Pilé d'Or throw. But, you know, that wasn't the memories for that trip aren't the Pilé d'Or. It's the climbing and the time.
But about that, I mean, your thoughts of on yourself as a... as a profile within the alpinism world, perhaps like a role model or a profile or kind of a, I don't know, celebrity, but...
definitely not a celebrity.
No, but you know what I mean? I mean, you are... people recognise you now.
Yeah, some people... I think very few people... I think you've got to remember that alpinism is such a small...
Of course. I don't mean like being recognized in the street, but I know.
I can go out for a meal without the paparazzi coming.
But I mean within the alpine community. Yeah. I mean, after all, you've been nominated and so on.
Yeah, but I think you have to. The alpine community is really small. People know each other. People know people that are active anyway. And I think the great thing about alpinism is there's so many people out there doing stuff that you don't know about. So many dark horses of alpinism that are just, I guess I've kind of embraced the commercial side of it a little bit. I haven't chosen to go into it, but I've got into it through working with companies, and it's been great. Don't get me wrong, I've enjoyed it. It's great working with companies, helping work on kit and trying out new kit and stuff. But you've got to remember at the same time, there's as many people like me that are working with companies, and there's as many people again that no one knows about that are climbing just as hard. And I've almost got more respect for they're just out there doing it. Mm-hmm. And I'd be out there doing it even if I wasn't a sponsored climber. I'd still be out there doing exactly what I'm doing now. If that makes sense. I'm in the fortunate position where it's easier to get some of the trips done now because I can get support from the North Face. But even if I'd still be doing the same thing if I wasn't sponsored. And I think that's the great thing about alpinism. You've got the mix of the two people. No one's doing it for the money or for the fame or glory. We're doing it because we just enjoy the bringing it down to basics and climbing. We enjoy climbing for climbing. And yeah.
But is there like a clash between the two kind of sides?
I don't think so. Mm. I just think, yeah, there's a lot of people out there I respect that, you know, names you can mention that you don't really, no one knows of, but they're just out there doing some pretty impressive, impressive stuff. And I don't think it's definitely not a clash at all. I don't think it's, if there's a clash, people are into it for the wrong reason, aren't they?
Not sure. But when it comes to your climbing and your skills, do you see a potential to grow as a climber? Where do you want to improve? Do you set up like goals for yourself?
Yeah, I guess I got into climbing rock climbing, and I guess if we go back to how we were talking about sacrifices for these trips, I guess the one thing that I have sacrificed has been my rock climbing, because I'm not climbing all the time, so I go the expeditions away are my holiday. So I don't get to do as much actual rock climbing as I'd like to. So I think going forward, I see myself doing a lot more rock climbing. I really like to improve my rock climbing because it's kind of plateaued for the last 10 years. You know, I look at, the grades I've climbed and I haven't really improved much on the rock in the last, but you know, my alpine experience has gone up twofold. Mm. I think I'd like to definitely get a lot more rock climbing done. I think one of my regrets from my climbing is training, proper training's kind of come through in the last few years for alpinism. Yeah, when I've been climbing, it's been my climbing that's kept me fit. Being out in Chamonix, you're out doing stuff during the day. I've never specifically trained, if that makes sense. Training to me has been climbing. It's been going out on the road bike. It's going out running in the evening. But I think one of my biggest regrets is that I haven't, and I don't have the time to do it now, but it would have been just interesting to see if we have a proper training structure, how fit it could actually have got. I don't know if that makes sense where I'm trying to get to. I think I've missed that opportunity for sure, because I don't have time to train full time now. But I think it would have been really interesting to see if I'd taken not a more professional approach, but if you'd actually really knuckled down and trained really, really hard and scientifically and properly, how fit you could have got. But maybe that would have taken the fun away from it as well. Yeah. You know, it's, to me, climbing's climbing and training is just going out riding my bike and running and, you know, never really taken a proper approach to it. And maybe that's why I've done it, because I enjoy it still. You know, if you start doing it, it may get a bit boring. I might not have embraced it as much. So yeah. I don't know. I don't think I wasted some time in when I had the free time I did in Chamonix. I didn't waste it, but I look back now and I'm thinking, oh, I could have maybe got more out of it than I did. But I had fun as well. Yeah, you get out to the bar with your mate. And
in the end, that's what
yeah. So it's, yeah.
Do you have any future goals and dreams that you want to and that you can share, like upcoming expeditions?
Yeah, I've got nothing definite planned at the moment. I'd quite like to go to India next year. I've never been to India and I've always been attracted by that. I think I see my trips in the future being maybe shorter trips to lower altitude peaks, because I think we've tried, when we've gone to site Linksar, we went to Chamlang last year, which is a 7,300 meter peak in Nepal. I think you've got to give yourself the time to get acclimatized, to get the weather. I've learned you can't rush it, and I know I won't have as much free time to commit to them as that. So I can see my maybe still doing a big trip like that once every 2 years or something, but in between doing a smaller, shorter trip to a lower, more technical peak, you know, a lower 6,000 meter peak where there's hopefully more chance of getting up it as well. So yeah, I don't know, maybe I'd like to go to India next year. And yeah, still definitely, to me, one of my big goals is to climb a cool new route on a 7,000 metre peak, and I still haven't done that. We didn't get up Lynx R, and I'd like to. That is something I definitely would like to achieve one day.
Tick
and
off
I hope,
the list.
Yeah, to tick, not just tick it, but I think, yeah, tick off the list and do it. Be, you know, to me as an alpinist, that's what it's about. Because there's a big, massive difference between, until you've tried it, I don't think you realise it, the difference between climbing at low 6,000s as opposed to getting up to 7,000. It doesn't sound much height difference, but there's suddenly a lot more stuff that comes into factor. Acclimatisation is way more important. You can go onto a 6,400 metre peak, and you don't have to be super well acclimatised because you're not actually at high altitude for that long. But as soon as the complexities involving when you take it up to over 7,000, it's just, I think it's a very different ball game, and it, on paper it shouldn't be, but it is for some reason. I don't know why. It's just, there's all these factors that make it. So to me, I really would like to do a big new route on a 7,000 metre peak, so it would be a nice achievement. But yeah, there's so many other adventures in climbing to be had as well. Had so many good trips to Alaska. I definitely
you had a go at or you summited Denali.
Yeah, I climbed the Slovak Direct with Nick, which still to this day is one of my best experiences in the mountains. It was just perfect combination of amazing climbing. We got hit by some weather, so we had the epic type 2 bit was thrown into it, and just absolutely special route. So then I think we summited, and we were really disappointed there wasn't, you know, Denali is this really popular mountain, and we got up onto where we joined the last summit ridge where we should join the normal route, and we kind of thought there'd be loads of people there. And for the factor of just, we'd had this pretty wild experience being pinned down by a storm for 16 hours in this tent, not knowing if we're going to get out of it, and we kind of, to see people would have been really nice. But also just to go, like, we've just done that. And I know as Brits we're meant to be modest and not shout about it, but We were just grinning from ear to ear, and we just wanted to tell people what we'd done, because it was just not to show off, just we were so psyched at what the route we just climbed, because it was an amazing route, and there's no one there. And we discovered that the weather had been that bad, no one had summited Denali for the last 3 days, and we'd been struggling up the big, nearly 3,000 metre south face. But yeah, that was Slovak Direct, goes down as probably one of my all time favourite climbing experiences. Just the commitment, the remote factor, the style of the climbing was really good. You don't often get such good quality climbing on a big route. There might be one or two pitches are really good, but this had like 1200 meters of really good, enjoyable, fun, fairly safe, hard, technical, but fairly safe, good gear climbing, which was really good. And then we got hit the Cassian Ridge and got some bad weather, and definitely I think Nick and I agreed that was one of our better adventures in the mountains.
So that's mixed climbing then?
Yeah, mixed climbing, yeah.
Ice axis,
all the climbing, yeah. I'm not a super strong rock climber, so that's what alpinism for me is, what I like. It's using a bit of rock climbing, a bit of ice climbing, you're using your axes on the rock. You keep climbing your axes and crampons all the time. It was really good, just like being in Chamonix, really. It's just awesome little ice, going up little ice runnels, and yeah, really. Really, really good. And the good thing about Denali was it took us 4.5 hours to get down the normal route. we spent 4 days climbing up, and it just took just over 4 hours to get really easy descent. So that was the good thing about Denali. Mm. Which people don't get, mates back home. It's like, well, why didn't you just go up that way? And it's like, well, yeah.
That's not what it's all about.
Yeah, that's what it's all about. So yeah.
Thank you so much for taking the time. Do you have anything you would like to add?
Covered
it all.
I think we've covered it all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Husky is produced in cooperation with Naturkompaniet, and it is powered by Nordic Green Energy, Sweden's greenest energy company with 100% renewable energy sourced from solar, wind, and hydropower. Find them at nordicgreen.se. The music is made by Joel Mull.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.